Major League Baseball Hall of Fame 2019. Who's in? Who's out? What changes have occurred within the Hall of Fame voting system? I'll talk about all of that and more with Wayne McDonald Jr. of Forbes and Forbes.com right now on the Long Ball Podcast with Andrew Brown.
From college to the pros, America's pastime in full force 24/7 on the Long Ball with Andrew Brown.
That's right, everybody. Welcome into the Long Ball Podcast with Andrew Brown. I am Andrew Brown. Glad you're joining me for my sixth edition, everybody. And for those of you who don't know, this is a podcast primarily revolving around collegiate and professional baseball. But from time to time, I'll dip my toes outside of baseball and talk about some really intriguing topics with some really intriguing people. Before we go any further, ladies and gentlemen, please make sure to catch me on the Anchor Podcast app. Again, Anchor Podcast, anchor.fm. Also, catch me and all my episodes on Twitter at abrown_13878, as well as LinkedIn and Facebook. And soon there will be many more avenues for you to catch me on, as well as iTunes. And coming up in a matter of weeks, my very own website regarding not only podcast episodes, but articles as well. So as we continue on, again, episode number six, everybody, if you can't tell, my voice has grown a little hoarse, and that's because I've been ill over the last couple of days, but rebounding is normal because the conversation must go on. And, you know, speaking about conversations, there's a conversation that you don't want to miss out on that happened in episode five of the Long Ball Podcast, as Chris Weichel of College Baseball Scouting Network joined me to talk about something that you'll want to know, and that is neuroscouting. That's right. Chris and I talked about neuroscouting, as that's the new age coming in the world of baseball. It was analytics, and now it will be neuroscouting, and you'll want to find out what that is and how it'll impact baseball. And you can do that by listening into episode five of the Long Ball Podcast on the Anchor app, and of course, on Twitter at abrown_13878. Right now, ladies and gentlemen, this will be an episode six talking about Major League Baseball, because there's a big event coming on up. Believe it or not, ladies and gentlemen, in a matter of just less than a week, Major League Baseball will be announcing its 2019 Hall of Fame class. Really, where has the time gone? It seemed like just a matter of weeks ago, we were in the winter meetings and we were foreshadowing months away from Hall of Fame voting. And then, believe it or not, ladies and gentlemen, we're just 30 plus days away from the opening of spring training. Crazy, right? Just absolutely nuts. But at last, here we are. And as I said, the conversation must go on. The conversation must happen. Now, the conversation for episode six will revolve around different nuanced changes and differences that have gone on over years within Major League Baseball's Hall of Fame voting process and the voters themselves. Now, here's the deal. We've seen steroid and alleged PED users over the years at first be shunned, people saying, no, you can't be in the Hall of Fame. And now we've seen individuals like Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, and so forth gain traction in the voting and get more votes. Now, I'm not saying PED use is good. I don't want it in the game of baseball. But that got me wondering, is the voting process, much like the game itself, progressing in a more, well, progressive nature? Is it bettering itself? And that's the type of question that I thought would be best answered, along with who should and should not be in for the 2019 Hall of Fame class, by the one and only Wayne McDonald Jr. of Forbes Sports Money and Forbes.com, talking all things baseball, a great baseball contributor for the website and the article. He joins us right now at this very moment. Wayne, always a pleasure to talk baseball in general with you, but now we get to talk Hall of Fame voting, and I am surely excited.
Oh, Andrew, thank you for having me. Looking forward to this conversation.
Now, Wayne, I'd like to start things off by taking a look at the 2019 Hall of Fame ballot. More specifically, taking a look at the first-time Hall of Fame ballot individuals. Now, we see some pretty big names out there, like Roy Halladay, the Sandman, Mariano Rivera, names like Lance Berkman, Freddie Garcia, Jason Bay, Roy Allswell, Miguel Tejada. I mean, there seems to be a lot of big names on them. And as we've seen the last couple of years, more notably last year, with the likes of Chipper Jones and Jim Thome, Hall of Fame voters are not afraid to put in first ballot individuals in. Now, my question to you is, taking a look at the list, and it's a pretty lengthy list, which of those individuals or which two individuals do you see more than likely making their way into Cooperstown after just one round?
I think that the first thing that we always have to look at when you get that ballot, when you look at the first year eligibles, and right off the bat, Mariano Rivera and Roy Hall, they just jump out. And for me, their first ballot Hall of Fame is without a shadow of a doubt. I think the argument with Mariano Rivera really essentially should be, is he a unanimous selection more than anything else? And for anyone who had seen Roy Halladay pitch in the prime years of his career, particularly if you were a fan of any team in the American League East in the late 90s, early 2000s, you never wanted to see him on the mound facing your favorite ball club because he was just dominant can be. And then he took it to the Philadelphia Phillies. His dominance continued. But for me, besides Mariano Rivera and Roy Halladay, I don't see any other people who are first-year eligibles who should be first ballot Hall of Famers. That doesn't necessarily mean I don't think those players are Hall of Famers. I think that first year, first time on the ballot, first ballot Hall of Famers is a very rare, unique, and extraordinary group of ball players. And that's why I think out of this outstanding group that we see right now as first-year eligibles, to me, Rivera and Halladay are no-brainers, but that doesn't necessarily mean, like, for me, I'm a big fan of Todd Helton, but he's not a first-ballot Hall of Famer. He's a guy that's probably going to be on the ballot for 6 or 7 years. Is going to have to build some support. You know, a guy like an Andy Pettit, you know, he's looking at possibly not even getting the required 5% to stay on the ballot, which is rather shocking. I think one of the lessons that I've learned so far in all these Hall of Fame debates and conversations throughout the years is that sometimes a ballot needs to breathe. And you need to really reflect on these plays very carefully. And it might take some time. And look at the case of Edgar Martinez. It's taken his 10th year of eligibility, but people are finally coming around to him. So I think with this group of first-year eligibles, the only surefire two players, in my opinion, that will be enshrined in Cooperstown are Rivera and Halladay. Everyone else, you know, I think it's going to take some time for them, and they're going to need some time to breathe.
And once again, everybody, we're with Wayne McDonald Jr. of Forbes Sports Money, Forbes.com, talking about the Hall of Fame class 2019 and Hall of Fame voting. Now, again, as we just referenced the first ballot nominees alone, there are so many names. In fact, 20 new names onto the ballot already with names like Barry Bonds, Billy Wagner, Fred McGriff, Edgar Martinez. Now, I know last year had a very dominant and deep class, including those two first ballot Hall of Famers, but I got to ask the question here, with all the big name guys that you see on this year's list, is the 2019 Hall of Fame ballot possibly the most deep and talented? What's your overall take on this?
I think there's a lot of strength here. I think it's a very impressive ballot. But my take on it really kind of boils down to a few things. I'm a big proponent of the WAR statistic, whether it's Baseball Reference or Fangraphs. It doesn't matter to me. I think that stat that you just eloquently stated is so spot on because it allows you to deeply appreciate the ballot. I look at names like Larry Walker. I mean, a lot of these players, I guess I look at because they played at a time when I started to write about the game and really studied the game, not just from a fan's perspective, but from an analytical perspective. And for the life of me, I'm perplexed at why Larry Walker hasn't received the support. And I'm really tired of hearing about the Rockies, Colorado, curse and everything. But guys like Messina starting to build momentum. A guy like Fred McGriff in his 10th year of eligibility on the ballot, you know, he's, you know, probably going to get about 35-40% support. But that means he's going to be a Veterans Committee issue at some point in time. A guy like Jeff Kent, you know, if he, this is a guy that was winning MVP awards playing alongside Barry Bonds. And then we know Bonds and Clemens and Manny Ramirez and Sammy Sosa, they fall into a different category. But, you know, look at a guy like Schilling. There was Scott Rowland. All of these players that you look at, and they had exceptional careers. But I think what's happened now is that it's going to take some time for some of these guys to get the love, respect, and admiration that they really deserve. And, you know, I think the big one that we're going to see next, because I think Edgar Martinez is going to get locked in easily this year, is that Mike Messina is going to be that guy. I think he might be the dark horse for this year. And then next year might be Larry Walker, who might fall in that category. So I think what we're seeing is there are an exceptional amount of elite ball players here on the ballot this year. I think the war statistic is something no one should deny. They should embrace it. But what's also telling us, too, is that some people are going to get overlooked. And that's why it's so important that they achieve the minimum 5% to stay on the ballot so they have time to get the respect, admiration, and love that they rightfully deserve.
And once again, everybody, joining me, Wayne McDonald Jr., baseball contributing writer for Forbes, Forbes.com Sports Money. Now, Wayne, I understand that when trying to narrow a big field into who you feel are the two, three, four, however many best players to be in the Hall of Fame, you have to find ways to narrow that field. Unfortunately, I feel that in today's age, we're getting to the point where more and more individuals are not just comparing one stats to the other, but I think they're tunnel vision on one particular part of a player's career, and they're not letting go of that. And I think the tunnel vision is negatively impacting all the voting. The biggest example I have of that is Billy Wagner. I mean, the guy is top two all time in relievers in terms of run prevention and runs saved. Yet a lot of people, including MLB's Phil Russo, continually look at his postseason numbers and his postseason only. Yes, through 12 innings pitched, he does have 13 earned runs. He does have three homers. He does have an ERA well north of 10. For me, when I look at it, for a lot of players, he may not even get to the postseason. And really, when you think about it, 97, if not 98 or 99% of a player's career is based in the regular season. So you can see where I'm getting at there, that tunnel vision focused solely, in this case, on the postseason and not the career body of work, which I believe is the real reason why an individual should be in the Hall of Fame. From your perspective, Wayne, what are your feelings on the tunnel vision kind of mindset within some MLB voters? And what is your take on Billy Wagner and his situation?
See, I look at all relievers right now in a different frame of mind, because for a long period of time, they were kind of the Rodney Dangerfield of the Hall of Fame process. They didn't get the respect. Like, the designated hitter has kind of assumed that mantle right now. I think now that you have Mariano Rivera, in all likelihood he will be in this year, Trevor Hoffman being in last year, those two guys' careers coincided with Wagner. And it's very hard when you have probably two of the greatest relievers of all time being in the same generation as you. And a guy like Wagner did get overlooked a lot. Now, I will say this. He is the guy, I will never forget it, sitting at Qualcomm Stadium where the Padres used to play. Padres versus the Houston Astros, sitting right behind home plate. Billy Wagner threw a baseball the hardest that I've ever seen. And I've seen a baseball game or two in my day, and I was just dumbfounded at a guy his size and the velocity coming out of his arm. And he was just downright impressive. I think he suffers in a couple of ways that he played in the era of Rivera and Hoffman. relievers aren't given the love and respect. Look at Lee Smith. He had to be a Veterans Committee selection. So a guy like Wagner in his fourth year of eligibility on the ballot, at this point, he's got to stay eligible and see if people come around to him. I think that's the big thing with a guy like Wagner, because after they kind of sift through Rivera and Hoffman, hey, there were other relievers during this era that were pretty dominant. And here's the analogy that I will put to it. A guy like Mike Messina suffered because he played in the same era as Greg Maddux, Randy Johnson, Pedro Martinez, and Tom Glavine. Those are four surefire first ballot Hall of Famers without a shadow of a doubt. However, that doesn't mean that Mike Messina is not a Hall of Famer. He might not be a first ballot Hall of Famer, but you know what? After you sift through those guys and you pay attention to Messina, people realize, wow, he's a Hall of Famer. And that's why you see the momentum you are with Messina. I think the same is going to happen eventually with Wagner. After the Rivera, after the Hoffman stuff, and people start to reevaluate their ballot going forward and start to look at Wagner, he might get a certain amount of love then that he is lacking right now. So I think it's too early to say he's a Veterans Committee type of player, because if he stays eligible, he has another five or six years going for him where things can change. But I think that's where Wagner falls, is that when you play in the era of Rivera and Hoffman, it's very hard for people to give you the respect and admiration that you deserve.
And once again, everybody, Wayne McDonald Jr. joining me on the Long Ball Podcast with Andrew Brown. Wayne McDonald Jr., baseball contributing writer for Forbes Sports Money, Forbes.com. Now, Wayne, when we talk about needing the 5% to stay on the ballot and those who have fallen off, you know, every year we see that. Every year we see individuals that we go, I really wish they would have stayed on. I don't know why they didn't get to stay on. We saw that with Jack Morris, Alan Trammell a year ago, well-deserving to get in with the Veterans Committee. But still, you see individuals that you feel really shouldn't have fallen off in the first place. For me, I go right to the likes of Jorge Posada and Bernie Williams. Two Yankees that are synonymous with the dominance of the 90s and early 2000s. That's immediately where my mind goes. And numbers show that. Yet they still fell off. And it's just amazing to me. Now, Wayne, when you look back at Hall of Fame ballots of years past, are there any individuals that really jump off the page to you that you go, man, I don't think they should have been knocked off the Hall of Fame ballot?
Well, I think you nailed my two, because it was kind of funny, because this is some of the things I'll be writing about this week. When I look at guys like Bernie Williams and Jorge Posada in particular, I think they got grossly overlooked because they played on the same team as Derek Jeter and Mariano Rivera. And the interesting thing that I can look at with regard to the Braves of the 1990s and the Yankees of the 1990s is the fact that the Braves have put into the Hall of Fame guys such as Chipper Jones and Greg Maddux and Tom Glavine and John Smoltz, even executives such as John Schuerholz and manager Bobby Cox. And they only won one world championship, but they had the 14 National League East titles and all that stuff. With the Yankees, 1996 to 2000, they won, 96, 98, 99, 2000. They won four world championships, and that would not have happened without the likes of Bernie Williams, who gets grossly overlooked in those core four conversations. A Jorge Posada, who also played in the era of a Mike Piazza and a Pudge Rodriguez, who are both Hall of Famers, and Posada holds up nicely against both of them in certain statistical categories. So those are two guys right off the bat that jump out at me, and also speaks volumes that if we're looking at the Yankee dynasty of the late 90s, early 2000s, you're telling me that they're all first ballot Hall of Famers in the likes of Derek Jeter and Mariano Rivera. And then also maybe you can include in the conversation Messina, but he played from 2001 on, who only had an opportunity to play limited opportunity with the Yankees in terms of postseason and World Championships, because they never won one with the Yankees. But that jumps at me right away that the Braves dynasty, which only produced one World Championship, has all these Hall of Famers, even executives, where the Yankees only had won four, we're only looking at two, and those guys dropped off the ballot very quickly. I guess one of the things I'm concerned about, if you're looking at it from an objective point of view, will Andy Pettit get the required 5%? Because right now, he is tracking in the neighborhood of 7.7%, and that doesn't bode well for him big picture. So, I think what we've seen with a lot of this is the overcrowded ballot, the PED issues, ball players who played the same position as iconic players getting grossly overlooked. And I think that's where guys like Williams and Posada fell into the category. Bernie Williams played the same position as Ken Griffey Jr. And Jorge Posada played the same position as Pudge Rodriguez and Mike Piazza, and they played in the same era. So how could they be as good as those guys are? Not every Hall of Famer is a first ballot Hall of Famer. Some players' journeys are a little bit longer than others, and that's why I feel disappointed in cases like Posada and Williams, why they're no longer on the ballot.
Once again, everybody, you're listening to the Long Ball Podcast with Andrew Brown. And make sure, again, to check me out on Facebook and also on Twitter at abrown_13878. I'll have all my shows uploaded there, as well as on LinkedIn and, of course, Facebook as well. And coming soon, iTunes. Stay in the know for that. But right now we're talking with Wayne McDonald Jr. of Forbes Sports Money, Forbes.com. He's one of their baseball contributing writers. Now, Wayne, I'm just going to go out and ask this pretty bluntly here. Before, in the intro of the show, I talked about changes to the Hall of Fame voting and referenced steroid and PED use. Now, even though, yes, Barry Bonds wasn't proven to have taken steroids, still linked to it, and then used to have the link and usage by Roger Clemens and so forth, within those individuals and that group of PED users, do you ever see those individuals ever making it to Cooperstown, or do you continually see them, whether it be fortunate or unfortunate, as outsiders looking in?
Well, I think in the case of Bonds and Clemens, we're seeing a little bit of a thaw occur with regard to their candidacies. Right now, both of them are tracking around 75%, which if the election ended today and the results were locked in, they're Hall of Famers. And we're seeing a little bit of momentum actually building for them. Now, it wouldn't surprise me in the next 2 years to see them enshrined, because I think what's happening is there is a different point of view with regard to performance-enhancing substances and players. I really do believe that began with Mike Piazza, Jeff Bagwell, and Pudge Rodriguez, because each of those players had to deal in their own way with regard to some speculation and rumors with regard to associations with PEDs. And I will never forget, I was at the press conference for introducing Jeff Bagwell and Pudge Rodriguez and others into the Baseball Hall of Fame. And one very brave reporter basically flat out asked Jeff Bagwell, did you do anything? And, you know, you never got a straight answer. Another reporter, even braver, put Pudge Rodriguez on the spot and said, did you ever do anything? And I never saw two men dance around questions in a very uncomfortable manner as they did. And I think what it boils down to is that you're seeing younger writers join the ranks of the Baseball Writers Association of America, who are now eligible to vote for the Hall of Fame, because it does take 10 years. You're seeing them saying, at PEDs, it really wasn't a big deal. You know, it wasn't illegal at the time. You know, Major League Baseball turned a blind eye to it, so it wasn't as big of a deal. So there's a little bit of a different thought process there, and we're seeing that with the ballots this year when we're keeping track of it. So I think when you're getting, you know, the newer voters coming in who are now eligible, who have a different take on PEDs than, say, the older voters who have been basically ruling the roost for several years. That's, I think, the first part that you're seeing where there's going to be some changes. And it's not going to surprise me in the next 2 or 3 years to see either one of them in Cooperstown. I just think it's inevitable. Sosa, I think, is a different story for the fact that I think people honestly and genuinely believe that the only reason why he put the statistics that he did was because of an association with PEDs. In the case of cases of Clements and Bonds, I think there is a prevailing thought that neither one of these individuals had to use anything because they were God-given natural gifts, talents, and abilities to be exceptional baseball players. And I think you're going to see some changes even with Manny Ramirez, even though he did fail drug tests, but they were implemented in the game at the time. So I think there is a different thought process being driven by the newly eligible baseball writers who can vote for the Hall of Fame, who are actually a little bit younger than the old guard, which is currently running the ballots.
Once again, everybody, you're listening to the Long Ball Podcast with Andrew Brown. I am Andrew Brown, and I'm talking with Wayne McDonald Jr. of Forbes Sports Money, Forbes.com, talking Hall of Fame. As we talk entry into the Hall of Fame, there has and always will be controversy surrounding a group of individuals or individuals themselves making it in. Now, you and I are both analytically inclined, yet I think it's fair to say that we both feel that it's really the Hall of Fame, not the Hall of Numbers. I mean, call me crazy, but, you know, 10 to 20, 30 years from now, I won't remember the likes of Harold Baines and his mediocre numbers. Even if he had stellar numbers, I wouldn't necessarily remember him as much. But I'll remember Jack Morris pitching in so many postseason appearances for Detroit, Toronto, even if Toronto was horrible, and even Minnesota. I'll remember those moments. I'll remember Pete Rose continually yielding the hits record of Major League Baseball. I'll remember Mark McGwire, despite him not holding a bat as a player for in 18, 19 years. I'll remember him and Sammy Sosa duking it out for the home run title. Yet then you have a lot of these analytically super individuals that only look at the numbers. And there's all this debate about Hall of Fame versus Hall of Numbers. So I really wanted to get your take here, Wayne. How do you feel that, or what do you feel the right viewpoint is with this? Should we view it as the Hall of Fame with some numbers thrown in, or the Hall of Numbers with some fame added in?
Well, the funny thing also as well, if you walk through the hallowed halls of Cooperstown in the Black Gallery, you know, I hate to say it, you know, you don't have, it's not comprised of choir boys. And, you know, Ty Cobb's in there, Roger Hornsby's in there. You have some people who were morally challenged. And I think it comes to a point too, because even though the Hall of Fame is a not-for-profit, educational institution, you know, people want to go there and they want to have a connection. You know, I remember watching Barry Bonds, the greatest player of all time. Let me go see him in Cooperstown. Oh, wait, we can't. Roger Clemens, 7-time Cy Young Award winner. I'd love to see him in Cooperstown. Oh, wait, can't. And there was a prevailing thought for some time, if you're going to let these guys in Cooperstown, maybe you put a mark on their plaque saying was associated with performance-enhancing substances. Well, you know, I think that's a little bit of cutting your nose to spite your face in that regard. And is that really the right answer to the question here? I think what we're seeing here is that, you know, like just like everything else, the Hall of Fame is a business. The Hall of Fame attracts, you know, around 280,000 fans per year in attendance, which is surprisingly low when you think about it, which is almost the equivalent to like 6 sellout games at Yankee Stadium, which is kind of shocking. But in the same token, you know, you don't want to bring an 8-year-old to the Hall of Fame and there's no deep and emotional connection with any of the players there. So I think it's a struggle of remaining relevant, having high standards, trying to uphold the sportsmanship, integrity, character clauses of the Hall of Fame, but also trying to put everything into perspective as well. So it's a very difficult position when it comes to looking at certain of these candidates.
And so, a quick side question to that, when we bring up the likes of Jack Morris and his entry into the Hall of Fame, albeit unorthodox, but still in there nonetheless, do you feel that when people look at it that way as Hall of Fame, not Hall of Numbers, do you feel that like that diminishes the level needed to enter the Hall of Fame, or do you feel it really strengthens the need to have such a dominant and notable resume?
I think you bring up a great example on Jack Morris, and I wrote a lot about Jack Morris over the years because he's one of those guys that was always on the fence. And, you know, the big thing was the ERA. He, you know, I think his ERA was 3.9. And it would have been the highest earned run average having any pitcher in the Hall of Fame. I think Hoyt Wilhelm was going to be the next one. But then the big other thing that you have to look at from Jack Morris, because Jack Morris really was, when I was really growing up in the 80s, really, that was my indoctrination into the game of baseball was during that decade. And Jack Morris was one of the best pitchers in the game. He was the winningest pitcher of the decade of the 1980s. At a time when the win statistic mattered. And, you know, he, to me, during that era, was the personification of an ace. He was the opening day starter. He was the number one man in the rotation. And he was the epitome of that. Now, granted, he did play for some Tiger teams where he did have a high ERA, but his mentality during that period was, okay, if the Tigers scored 5 runs in the first inning, I can give up 4 runs, we still win the ball game. It was a different mentality. Now, that doesn't mean it's right or wrong, but that was just a different way the game was being played. Now, that doesn't bode well from an analytical perspective because he doesn't fare well in the analytics compared to a guy like a Mike Messina. You know, when you start drilling thanks to the analytics, you go, wow, completely different story. I think what you look at, and we all struggle with it, there is that deep and emotional connection that you have to a certain franchise, certain ball players from the era in which you became indoctrinated in the game of baseball, and then looking at the cold, hard facts of the statistics, thanks to the analytics now, because there isn't a hard, concrete criteria. Now, at one point in time, it used to be, hey, if you were a pitcher, you got 300 wins. Your ticket was going to be punched to Cooperstown. If you were a hitter, if you had 3,000 hits or 500 home runs, your ticket was punched to Cooperstown. But PEDs changed the playing field with regard to how we do that, because if that were the case, Gary Sheffield would have been a Hall of Famer a long time ago. Roger Clemens, you know, Barry Bonds, Manny Ramirez, Sammy Sosa, all, you know, it would have been a completely different situation. But due to the fact that there isn't that hard and fast concrete criteria in terms of how we are evaluating players for the Hall of Fame, everyone takes a different approach to it. And I do believe in my heart of hearts that the baseball writers who are eligible to vote do an outstanding job. They do their homework on top of the eye test in terms of watching these players throughout their distinguished careers. They actually do extensive research in terms of the data and the analytics and comparisons, and that's all part of it. But there isn't this hard and fast way of looking at it. But it does also say that it is an elite fraternity and there has to be some substance to it. And I think Morris's election last year, you would challenge some people to think differently. And without question, Harold Baines' election by the Veterans Committee has changed everything dramatically. But I think it's a different conversation because I think the baseball writers do an excellent job. And I think they've done an excellent job for a very long time. And I think the Veterans Committee has made some questionable selections, which has muddied the overall water in terms of how we evaluate Hall of Fame voting in general.
And once again, everybody, you're listening to the Long Ball Podcast with Andrew Brown as I wrap up my Hall of Fame Major League Baseball conversation with Wayne McDonald Jr. of Forbes Sports Money at Forbes.com. Now, Wayne, we talk about the questionable calls and decisions made by the Veterans Committee. Now, I agree with you. 2 years ago, Alan Trammell, Jack Morris, home runs. Harold Baines more than made up for it in the wrong way. His OPS alone is not even half of what the likes of Posada and others who have fallen off the ballot are. And most of the Hall of Fame ballot nominees right now have far outdone what the likes of Harold Baines has, yet they're not in. So with that, do you feel that that's grounds to put, you know, more restrictions or a more strict code on what the Veterans Committee does?
Well, I think if you look at the long history of the Veterans Committees throughout the Hall of Fame voting going back to the 30s up until present day, there is one word that immediately comes to mind for me, and that's cronyism. You know, in the various iterations of the Veterans Committees, there has always been an element of, oh, he was my teammate, or I played with that guy, or I played against that guy. And, you know, sometimes it worked in your favor as a fan, sometimes it didn't. But I think what happened with Harold Baines had set such a distinct tone, and the immediate tone, and he hasn't wavered in any way since, is just this profound negativity. If you were to take Fred McGriff for a second, because he's not going to get the requisite 75% this year, and he's going to be off the ballot because it's his 10th year of eligibility. He's going to be a today's game candidate probably at the winter meetings in 2021. If you were to do a head-to-head with Baines and McGriff, now mind you, Baines played in 370 more games than McGriff did in his major league career. McGriff is better than Baines in runs created, runs, home runs, base on balls, on base percentage, slugging, OPS, OPS plus, WAR, isolated power, and weighted runs created plus, just to name a few. But the baseball writers don't view him worthy of a Hall of Fame selection, but look at what the Veterans Committee does. So a guy like Fred McGriff, I think, could change the tone again, just like Alan Trammell did. The last year, the Veterans Committee got it right with Alan Trammell. And I hope they get it right someday with Lou Whitaker and maybe a Bobby Gritch and other players, Keith Hernandez and other players of that ilk, where they regressed this year with the selection of Harold Baines, as Harold Baines will become a Hall of Famer, while Fred McGriff will drop off the baseball writers' ballot this month. And it does speak volumes in terms of what is the Veterans Committee doing. What metrics? You know, the thing is, you're not even allowed to question them in terms of what their metrics were, what they used for evaluation, how did they prepare? You know, and we saw what happened when Chris Russo pushed Tony La Russa on the whole Harold Baines thing. He got very defensive, and it was, well, I saw him with my own eyes. Well, that's great. All of us have seen players with our own eyes, but what did you look at that made him stand out among everyone else? And I think that's where there's a lot of controversy with the Veterans Committee, where the writers are very transparent. Sometimes it works to their benefit, sometimes it doesn't, but at least they put themselves out there for the criticism, and they're willing to take it, whereas the Veterans Committees throughout the years kind of hide behind this shroud of secrecy rather than saying, here's why I didn't think George Steinbrenner was a Hall of Famer. Here's why I didn't vote for Don Mattingly, or so on and so forth. You don't get that from the Veterans Committee like you do with the baseball writers. And that's why I think there's such a big difference, where coming through the Hall of Fame through the baseball writers, I think, has a little more prestige than coming through from the Veterans Committee.
And with that, ladies and gentlemen, unfortunately, we'll have to call it a day on this episode and the conversation with Wayne McDonald Jr. of Forbes and ForbesSportsMoney.com. Wayne, it's always a pleasure to have these kind of conversations with you because they're so in-depth and really so head-turning, but in a great way. I mean, you really dive into the nuances of things and bring out history in the right moments. Always great, always enlightening, as always. I'm sure the listeners had just as much fun as you and I did. But overall, thank you so very much for gracing the show once again.
Andrew, always love talking baseball with you. I always feel I learned so much in our conversations, and thanks for having me on once again.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, and with that, please don't forget to check me out on the Anchor Podcast app. Also, check out my Twitter page at @abrown_13878 for this full conversation. Also, check me out on LinkedIn as well. I'll have my stuff posted there as well as Facebook. And, of course, a whole lot more coming on up. Please don't forget to check out when I announce the website coming on up for articles and, of course, all the Long Ball episodes. And, of course, once again, a big thank you to Wayne McDonald Jr. of Forbes Sports Money Business and Forbes.com. He's also a clinical professor of sports management. If you're up in the area, please check him on out. Also, check him out on Twitter at WMCDONN25. That's WMCDON25. Again, check him out on Twitter. And, of course, ForbesSportsMoney.com for all his great articles. Just released a few of them. So, again, a big thanks to Wayne McDonald Jr. And a big thanks to you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening in. It's just not the same without you. So, just as they say in the show business, until next time, folks.